My guest today started as a backup dancer in Los Angeles. Then he went to war. Then SpaceX. Then Northrop Grumman. Then Harley Davidson. And at every single stop, he kept finding the same broken system hiding in the same place. The seam where road and rail are supposed to hand off to each other. Nobody had fixed it. Not the military, not the biggest aerospace companies in the world, not anyone. So Kevin DeMoa built the fix himself. He's the founder and CEO of Glide Technologies, and what he's building could reshape how freight moves across the country and how supplies reach our troops in contested environments around the world. This one is layered, and I couldn't wait to sit down with him. Welcome to 50 Chairs and the Kevin DeMoa story. All right, we're in. We're live.
We're live.
Well, Kevin, you and I had a chance to chat a little bit previously, and I'll give you a little bit of the backdrop of 50 Chairs as we kind of went through this. But how I came to know you was through Mike Sherbakoff. I said, "Hey, yeah. Mike, I'm looking for some incredible founders to talk to." And I said, "Who's at the top of your list?" And Mike said to me, "Kevin DeMoa," like without hesitation. So I was like, "All right, well then I need to talk to Kevin." And I know you've been on a whirlwind of both exciting successes with TechCrunch, a Disrupt win, and just a lot going on, and new hires, and you know all the things that are going on with you. So I'm super grateful that you joined us today on 50 Chairs. And I shared a little bit of that journey. Go ahead.
No, I'm just going to say the honor is absolutely mine. So sorry.
No, you're fine, man. I shared a little bit of the context of 50 Chairs with you. As you know, my dad was a pastor and started a church. And part of that learning as I was growing up was it really takes a lot of conviction when you set out those chairs at the beginning and no one's there. And as I've read and kind of come up to speed on your story, man, there's no shortage of 50 chair moments. But yeah. For the audience, you know, Kevin has been at all of the companies that you have seen in the headlines recently, SpaceX, Harley Davidson, I had one more on my list. I mean, you've been a lot of places. And before that, even that journey started in the military, and then before that in LA. So I want to start kind of at the beginning. Yeah. So back, not with SpaceX, not with the military, but the one story that Mike did tell me that I was like, that is interesting. He's like, you know, the one thing you may not know about Kevin is he was a backup dancer in LA. So I want to start there. So walk me through that. What was happening? Like where what was that journey? Mm-hmm. And I'd love to hear more of that story.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you know, so dancing and art is a big piece of my life. You know, it's in everything that is around me. If you watch me, you know, publicly or live, I'm always tapping into like that music. It's just going. So grew up dancing, you know, and the dancer, and loved hip hop and being a b-boy. Supposed to go to college for dancing and ended up joining the army instead. It was during 9/11. I said, do I want to support this nation or do I want to go entertain? And I felt God put me on this earth to earn my keep and, you know, I could serve in this nation. But, you know, after, you know, I got back to Iraq, you know, two tours in Iraq, I said, a cat only has nine lives. I use nine already. I'm going to go dance. So moved to California to pursue the California dream. And, you know, I got recruited as a backup dancer. You know, everybody knows the dancer's journey. Live in a dancing house, you know, with a bunch of other dancers. You eat ramen noodles and Vienna sausages because you're not getting paid a lot. And you're going to, like, you know, auditions all the time. You know, so I got picked up to be a backup dancer. I danced for about 6 months. I was doing choreography and contemporary hip-hop as well. And then the San Diego fires happened. I was down in San Diego at the time and actually went down to be a volunteer firefighter. And I saw that I loved it. I said, well, the Lord has called me to doing this mission. So I quit dancing and I went to go fight fires, man. National Guard and fought for almost. So, yeah.
Wow, man. Wow. Well, that's kind of an amazing journey to kind of go through. You know, from backup dancer to military to firefighting. I do want to pick up on a theme here, because I know that you mentioned, you know, God was part of that decision for you. And I will say, in, you know, some of the conversations that I have around this, the 50 chair story, the part that I don't talk about a lot is, you know, as my father was going through that and setting out those 50 chairs, you know, he was doing it because he felt a calling on his life. And I feel like entrepreneurship can kind of be a calling of sorts. And you talked about hearing that voice and saying, hey, this is what I need to go do. So do you mind walking through that a little bit? It's not normally where I go, but since we were there, do you mind talking about it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's in the Bible says, be still and send me, right? You know, and, you know, I take that literally, and I've done that with every single thing that I've done in my life. My favorite book growing up was Ecclesiastes. So it talked a lot about wisdom and knowledge and how do you accumulate things. So I combined, you know, the teachings of Ecclesiastes with those two terms of being still, sitting with, you know, where you are in the moment and the gifts that God showed on to you, and being sent out for a purpose that is outside of our desire. My desire was to dance, to do things in life that made me feel fulfilled and really pour it to others. God provided me with gifts and logistics and operational excellence, building things to serve that aren't always honest. They're probably the toughest and most mundane things to do to move us, the people, you know, where I had to pay attention to calling. And you know, even though it's placed in harm's way, still, you know, I'm here to serve. I'm still inside of it, so
let's go back a little bit further. So when you were growing up, I know you shared a little bit of kind of your origin story, but you shared that your family's Panamanian. You were out in LA. What did success look like for you? Like when Kevin was thinking about like, hey, future Kevin, this is the road that he's going to follow. You know, what did that look like for you? What did you think was going to happen?
I thought I was going to be an entertainer, man. I thought I was going to be this like big, like superstar. Cause I, you know, I dance, I sing, I play instruments and I write. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to be the next Usher, you know, that's, you know, I'm going to be Usher mixed with El General. And, you know, and I'm going to be that guy. You know, that was like, this is what I'm working towards. You know, I played sports. I was in great shape. But like entertainment was where I directed a lot of my energy growing up. You know, to folks, I did like talent shows. And I was a part of like a boy band. I was in every single church choir. You know, my parents wanted to, you know, go to, you know, my mom wanted to, she hopped around from church to church denomination growing up. And I always, you know, participated in all the musical things in church. So I knew for a fact my path was to be that, you know, that next Usher Raymond. You know, I didn't plot a course outside of that, right? I was always fascinated with, you know, building things. I was into like Fast and the Furious and building my own cars and everything else. But that was always an entrance into entertaining others. Where my personal pursuit was as far back as I can remember.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. So do you think that some of that, that background, I mean, they always say like looking backwards, you can always connect all the dots, but do you think some of that background has helped you in what you're doing now? Like, do you see a through line in like, hey, those experiences were not wasted experiences, because they've actually helped me develop into the thing that I'm doing now.
Yeah, absolutely. I believe it all tells a story. If you follow like my timeline, you'll see a lot of like art and music and, you know, just a unifying of things, a harmony in what we do here at Glide as well. Everything we do is dual purpose, is duality, the road and rail and commercial and defense, you know, nationwide to international. And the music that we put together is like trap meets rock and roll. When you see a lot of the things here, you know, it's always a play on how do you combine things that sit on opposite sides of things and make them beautiful into one. So a lot of entertainment into what I do. I believe that, you know, being a storyteller, as well as, you know, a founder, is kind of like a musician. You know, where musicians have to, you know, tell their story through their music and through their performance. I feel as a CEO, I'm doing the exact same thing. I worked in sales, you know, quite a bit during my time, during my professional time, from selling concrete to power tools, you know, doing contracting within the military as well. Me, you know, pitch customers and investors and win the hearts and minds of customers and believers in our community as well, as we build out this, you know, this mission. So,
yeah, you know, I asked you that question because there's a lot of young folks who are, you know, this AI disruption that's happening is unfortunately affecting, you know, this particular group, 18 to 24, right? And I think looking backwards, you can always see like, oh yeah, man, that experience. Like, so I did door-to-door right out of college, right? I mean, yeah. I graduated, there were no jobs. And so I went into sales. And if you had asked me at that moment of time, did I love that? No, I did not love that. But I mean, it was door-to-door, straight commission sales. Yeah, yeah. It was like the worst kind of sales, you know, the hardest kind of sales.
Were you selling baseball tickets?
No. So it's interesting. I was selling, we were outsourced feet on the street program. So we worked for like AT&T and Quest and this will date me, AOL. Like, you know, there was a I should have left the AOL out of that.
Yes, it's okay, man. We'll edit it out.
Yeah. But that was an uncomfortable part of my journey. And I wouldn't have chose that myself. But looking backwards, when I went into the classroom, I was able to see in retrospect that those 3-minute pitches that I had to do to those business owners made me such an incredible teacher. Because I felt like my job was to convince these students to like listen to me, to find importance. I was used to that like 3-5 minute kind of get you interested. And that's incredibly important in teaching. And so as people are listening to this and people thinking about like their future, you know, it's like, hey, it may not always make sense at the time, but there is this through line. I can see it in the work that you do, you know, that kind of coolness factor that comes through in even in the design of your even in the design of your vehicle. So I love that, man.
Thank you, so, brother. I appreciate that.
Yeah, of course. Of course. So when you said, you know, you felt a 9/11 hit and you felt like you were, you know, called to go serve. Walk me through that. So you're, as I read the story, you know, you're working in some pretty tough situations and you're living the problem that you're solving now.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're in, walk the audience through that scene. Like, what was the origins of like, where were you? And then the moment you realized like, this is a problem. And I know this problem has happened several times in the other companies that you've been with, but let's start with the military chapter.
Yeah, absolutely. So Army, 3rd ACR, Brave Rifles to all my Brave Rifle folks out there. And that's when we were armored cavalry. They're a regular cavalry regiment now, and they've gone to light. But, you know, first tour in Iraq, you know, we were like, hey, bring your Bradleys and your tanks up. We got to move this stuff from this point to this point. Process is called railheading. You know, you have to move the tanks, Bradleys, and all of our equipment from road to rail. And we have to do this all ourselves. We are it. And they're explaining to us the process. And it's like, hey, you know, roll up to the train and lash this down with some chains and turnbuckles. And, you know, we're out there all day. It's blazing hot. You know, we're exposed every day. You know, it's like sitting ducks. And work is, you know, imagine, you know, 20 to 100,000 pounds of things swinging in the air, which you have to put down and then lash down. There has to be a better way. And then, you know, this is the only way, you know, and I'm like, it can't be. The army is so advanced that, you know, we have all this money. This can't, this is like Flintstones, man. They're like, oh man, this is how we're going to do it. And this, and so do your job. And, you know, I would leave the army with that discussion and then go on to the side and start to look at ports and corporate operations can see that that's the exact same way that everyone's, you know, so I'm like, well, I guess I'm going to live with the problem. So, you know, let's fast forward, I'm an age myself, fast forward 15 years. And I'm like, well, COVID-19 is now happening. And I'm like, well, why are these ships in the ports and not being able to get off boats fast enough? And you start to look at the diagram and you're like, well, these guys aren't offloaded fast enough. These tall stacks aren't getting processed fast enough. And then these trains aren't happening at all. Like you have a line of trucks at the gate because they're not doing that operation because it's expensive, it's slow, and it's very, very dangerous. And I felt like it was a God again tapping me on the shoulder saying, hey, you know how to fix it now. I put you at SpaceX where you did, you know, movement of rockets. Now I put you at, you know, Northrop Grumman where you're doing F-35. And then I gave you, you know, 4 startups doing electrification. You now have all your tools to solve this problem. So it's either you keep making bicycles or you go out and you be still. So I left Harley Davidson. And started at Glide and been gliding ever since.
Well, what was the, you know, it, each one of those, I mean, you think about logistics, and logistics seems like this, you know, some kind of unsexy business. Yes. Of sorts. But as I was reading about kind of the briefing on the rail and understanding what happened, as I understand, there's 140,000 short line across the U.S.
Yeah, it's 150,000 complete miles. Short lines have, I think, 61,000 of that number. Interesting thing about that number is 1916, we had 250,000 linear miles of rail within the United States. With now that number being down at 140,000, with the amount that we lost, they're now walking trails.
Really? So they were converted.
Absolutely. They're converted. Due to underutilization.
Okay. And so as I was kind of looking at, okay, so you've got all of this capacity that was kind of sitting there. And then I believe there was a law that was passed that kind of changed how rail worked. And so these short lines basically got underutilized. And so you saw this, this, you know, so-called declining usage as an opportunity. What was the spark? Like, how did you know? Was it just through experience as you kind of went through this and said, look, there's like so much rail out there. If we could combine both rail and, you know, off rail, you know, we could really utilize this. What was that moment for you where you, that light bulb went off?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, it was a lot of research. It was the pain from the past mixed with the learnings from the journey and then digging deep with the stakeholders. And when I say the stakeholders, I mean the shippers, the railroad operators, the drayage folks, and then the communities that these rail lines, you know, actually operate in, and, you know, marginalized communities at that. You know, these are folks that at the peak of rail, you know, had bus towns, right? And now these communities are poverty, you know, and inundated with, you know, abuse, you know, name your abuse, drug abuse, alcohol, whatever it may be, because those away. As that rail line declined and died in a lot of these instances. So that was my big carrot, that support the community. The next was, you know, we've invested all this time and resources into this infrastructure that can actually, you know, literally reindustrialize America. If you look at near shore and things past, we're only utilizing one corridor because it's really accessible while the other corridor just stays dormant. And that corridor, mind you, is more efficient, it's more effective, and it's cheaper across the board. You know, talk about bringing down the cost of goods sold, the cost of eggs and fighting tariffs. You shift things over to that mode and you directly impact the way that goods are processed in our stores, right? So those are the items that I wrote in on. And the last piece was like, I can make this sexy. Right. So take, you know, existing legacy systems.
So I want to dig into that. I was a couple of weeks ago, I was at an event with Kathy Wood, and she was talking about the amount of investment that went into AI, and there was a 150-year horizon. So it was looking at the investment in rail, and rail was like at the tail end of this, and then you've got AI, right, as the new boom, right? And the amount of money going into AI is way outpacing the rail and even the dot com boom and all of that stuff. If you look at it over the long tail. Mm-hmm. What I think is really interesting about what you're doing is that you're on both ends of this spectrum. And you talked about these communities. You know, I can only imagine that during that first railroad boom, these communities were bustling because of as rail was getting invested, that meant jobs. And then as that has declined, I don't want to say that that's a forgotten part of the community, but I would imagine as you've been doing this, you're seeing areas that just were left behind.
Absolutely.
And so talk me through a little bit of, what that's like. Is that part of the mission? Is there a social aspect to, hey, we want to revitalize? Not only does it make sense to revitalize these short lines from an economic perspective, but it also makes sense from a social well-being perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a core part of our thesis, is to, build around these communities. As we look at, the silver jobs, right? The silver age jobs, are the hardworking, back-breaking, blue-collar jobs are starting to go away because, the new generation's coming in. Are looking at, AI jobs to, do the work. Whereas we can, take a technology like Glide and inject ourselves into these communities and provide them with real generational wealth in the form of next gen jobs and education to bolster an industry that is essential, like logistics, so that we don't have these marginalized communities, right? Technology is what lifts communities up to an economic level so that they can, push the economy up. At the exact same time, I'm looking at, rail adjacent towns, port adjacent towns, and then towns where, distribution centers and e-commerce have lent itself to. You have, Amazon and Walmart facilities on all these places that are about a quarter of a mile to a half a mile from a railroad track that is now dormant, that is adjacent to a community whose job is only to do warehousing jobs. With those, a lot of those jobs being automated, and those jobs don't come outside of the facility. So now with our technology, as robotics goes in, now we can train folks on jobs on the outside to bolster their economy, leverage existing infrastructure for what it is with very, very little lift, and still inject capital into these communities to build them out as they service those main corridors is the thought process behind that. So that's a key piece of our business. And we're doing it slowly. So we're going, city by city, town by town, county by county, state by state. And eventually we want to break out into the world, but definitely want to be a big part of the mechanism as a part of American reindustrialization as we, push the nation forward.
Yeah, I love that part of the mission. And that, the more I've kind of learned about rail, it's such a, I don't know if you, maybe I'm just being Pollyannish about this, but there's something about being on a train that I say that is very different way of travel, right? Even as a customer of, Amtrak and traveling, I did a trip once from DC to Florida, very different on a train. You get to see, I don't know. I feel like you get to enjoy that journey a little bit more than you do on a plane, right? Not fast.
Absolutely. Yeah, not fast. Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely being still. I mean, you have nothing to pay attention and be present while you're on a train, man. I mean, it's so historical. I mean, it gives me chills thinking about it now. The first real big, after the horse and carriage, right, was, the industrialization or the of trains. Like trains are what connected our nation together via the Transcontinental Railroad. So think about, that invention and what it did to our economy as Americans. And then the next, big leap was containerization. But between those two, I mean, it changed the course of the world. And then of course, roads came up and, trucks, started to do its thing. But, those rail lines are still there and they still move a lot of American and other industries around the world. But they could move a lot more, is our point, right?
And that is your mission.
Yes, sir. That's our mission. Yes.
So when I've talked about this, I've called it kind of the ugly middle or the wilderness. You know, when you first set out, I'm sure when you started telling people, hey, I've got this idea. It's going to be a train and a car, you know, and I feel like that's a, like with everything that's going on, it's like maybe almost like what?
Yeah.
Kevin's talking about trains. We're talking about like drones and flying. And he's like, no. Let me explain this to you.
Yes.
And I feel like every entrepreneur has that moment when something is new and innovative and people just don't quite get it yet. Talk me through, what was that like for you as you were like, hey, I see a real problem. Mm-hmm. I've lived it.
Yes.
I've lived it through multiple companies now. But then when you say it out loud to somebody who doesn't quite understand it, what was that like as you were setting out those initial chairs and talking to people about what you wanted to do?
Yeah, it was a tough journey, to be honest. I mean, it's laughable now where we are. But in the beginning, I was like, as the founder that sees it all happen in real time, and you have the war wounds from it all, and you can point to all the data, right? That is like, dude, this is like out there. It's like it's exposed. There's a lot to it. You know, if you just pull on a little bit of these threads to expose it more, you know, you explain what you're going to do. And they're like, wow, man, that sounds like some like sci-fi Jetson stuff, bro. Like, yeah, you're probably like a decade out from where this is. Even though you explain, hey, the problem is like now. There's like 120 million people that are impacted by the same problem. There's like billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars that this problem, you know, that is paid towards this problem for it to go away, but it never does. You know, you show the statistics and then you show the solution and it doesn't add up. So words didn't do it. So we put it in CAD and then showed images of it. That didn't do it. It was like, wow, that's a great thing, but I don't think it's gonna, not in our lifetime. And then it all happens, right? COVID happened. Then you had geopolitical tensions that happened, and then you started to see catastrophic failures throughout the United States start happen, right? And that directly affected, you know, our American tables, where folks are like, oh, well, how is this impacting us? Oh, the rails are, this is the reason, the roads and the rails and the boats, man, who's going to help this? Who's going to solve this, right? And, you know, it's like, hey, we've been hiding in plain sight. We've been, you know, actually jumping up and down saying that we're here. But I think it's time and place, you know, for everything. You know, working at SpaceX when I first joined, no one believed that we were going to launch rockets, recover them, then relaunch them again. You know, to that point, they were, you know, throwing first stages into the oceans, and SpaceX had to show them, hey, this is a possibility. And I feel, you know, as entrepreneurs, it is our responsibility to demonstrate while we educate folks on how we solve this big problem. Right? We can't put something in front of a person and say, hey, you figure it out. It looks great, right? Now you figure the rest out. No, it's a continuous, you know, educational on the why, right? And the re-education on the why while you evolve the product offering at the same exact time. Because that's, as emerging technologies comes, it introduces more problems. So we have to evolve that and then teach why that our solution is still the right solution for that new problem that popped up because of this new technology that has evolved. So yeah.
Yeah. You know, I feel like as I'm listening to your story, entrepreneurs, when you pitch that first couple people, if you're lucky, you get in front of somebody that really understands and maybe probably just believes in you.
Yeah.
And I know you and I have a mutual colleague who in Josh Baer, who, as you know, recently passed. And I just would be remiss if we didn't pause and just acknowledge, for me and for you, Josh had an important role for Living Tree. He was the one that introduced me to my then future acquirer. And there was just something about him. I was early days and I would, you know, I was talking about my vision and he saw something in me that honestly, I don't think I saw in myself, but it made me believe. And I saw your post on LinkedIn. How important are those moments as you're, you know, walking through and describing to people what's happening and you meet a Josh Baer who says, man, Kevin, I believe in your vision. And not only I believe in your vision, I'm going to open doors. And I don't, and you're like, I don't understand why this guy's doing this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Joshua was, he's a titan. Like I said in my post, man, you know, what he's done, you know, for the community is amazing. He's opened up doors for all of us to actually, you know, solve some of the toughest problems in the world. The folks that are courageous and brave enough to do things, he's the one that planted seeds in order for us to grow into who we are today. You know, I call him the seed planter, and a lot of folks call him the seed planter. I have this saying that I love quite a bit, where we know as leaders, we plant seeds for trees that we'll never be able to enjoy the shade from. And that's just Joshua. You know, Joshua planted seeds and watered them, as he liked to say, you know, that are growing into, you know, great successful companies, from, you know, Firehawk to Firestorm to, you know, Glide. Within itself, just by the kindness of his heart. He didn't have to do any of this. You know, he didn't have to help you out to do it, but he's ways where he can have incremental gains, or not him specifically, but us as a community can have incremental gains through people, right? I feel that we're all conduits, and there's certain ones, it's like a theory of mine, there's certain people out there that just see the conduits walking and say, oh, I'm going to grab onto this person, or I hope this person comes to me, or we're brought to their door and they're like, yeah, come on in, man. I saw you coming. Right. And that's the impression that, you know, Joshua always had on me, man. Yeah, I miss him. You know, I miss him. He's an incredible man. And, you know, we're going to push harder because of, you know, the belief that he has, I know, in all of us. So yeah, thank you for mentioning.
Yeah, of course. I feel like I'd be remiss if we didn't today. So as you've been out there and building, how important has, I saw your wall, we talked about this early on, you've got no shortage of just reminders of great people, and surrounding yourself with that imagery. I know, as you told us your background, I know how important that is. I've talked about athletes and visualization. Someone said the 50 chairs was like, for my dad, a way of visualizing something that didn't exist yet. How important have mentors been, and how have you kind of found them as you're kind of going through and making your collection, or that board, or if they become a board member, what part of the journey has mentors played in your journey?
A steady support channel for me, you know, for a lot of my blind spots. You know, it takes a lot for, you know, a lot of us to surrender, you know, whole self, you know, so that we can take those learnings. You know, I've had my entire life, I've been surrounded by folks that wanted to pour into me, and I had to stop and listen. I stop and listen a lot more now. And the journey just places these folks at the time they're supposed to be, chronologically or systematically, whatever you want to, you know, call it, and seasons in your life that is needed. And I have the ability to surrender to those moments, you know, where I have like folks like Pablo Ucar, or Mike Sherbakov, or Ryan Micheletti, or Jordan Kretschmer, or Tim Draper, tap me in the shoulder and say, hey, I see something in you, but these are your blind spots. You know, would you sit and listen? You know, that's easier said than done, right? It was a point in my life where I was like, hey, would you sit and listen? I was like, now I'm on a move. If you want to run with me, we can run together. But, you know, you're missing a whole story. So, you know, the advice that I would give to anybody out there, if this is a place where I can give advice, is to listen to the lessons that are given to you and pointed out to you. They come in all shapes, forms, and sizes and opportunities. You know, we were at an event yesterday, 2 days ago, so my times are off, in Long Beach, just, you know, talking with customers and potential partners and stuff like that. And I had the lovely moment to meet with a woman named Bonnie Nixon. And Bonnie Nixon, if anybody wants to do research on her, is this huge innovator for logistics. She's helped out ports to, you know, push them into next gen, you know, arenas to be successful, right? As we, you know, tackle commercialization and everything else. And, you know, we talked for like an hour. You know, and in that small session, she dropped me with a bunch of different pieces of knowledge. So on the fly mentorship is really, really important as well. It doesn't have to be, you know, something as formal as an advisor or mentor or board member. You know, mentorship comes in momentary things as well. We just have to sit and digest and sit with those lessons in those moments. So
you mentioned surrender, and that's not a word I hear very often, except maybe in church.
Yeah.
And I feel like maybe it's worth kind of going through just a little bit of that in terms of my definition of surrender, and you tell me if this is what you meant by that, is more a posture of your heart and your mind, not a physical surrender to, you know, anything that comes your way, but a openness to God's will and calling and whatever that might look like. And that might be a small moment or a big moment, but just having a posture of surrender.
Yes.
Is that how you would define surrender?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It isn't the lay down and say, hey, come and take me. No, it's, you know, it is. It is, as you explained it, a posture in sense to be fully open to the lesson as it is, right? I think the thing that keeps us from, you know, the lessons that we have is that external shell, that ego, that pride that says I have enough, where your vessel is partially empty or more than empty, right? You're on your bottom, but your vessel is still at a posture of strength where you should be receiving that lesson. So surrender allows you to open all the way up from a posture in order to get your cup filled by those lessons that come from surrender, I feel.
Yeah, and I feel like I love that idea of on-the-fly mentorship, right? Because a lot of times you, as a founder, you think about this like, oh, I need, you know, a mentor. I want this person on my board. But, you know, sometimes it's just a season. Sometimes it's just a conversation that you needed at that moment, right? So it doesn't have to be this big, complicated, formal thing. It can be just a, hey, I had this amazing conversation and that changed my thinking on something that, you know, was placed on my heart or something that, you know, the business is going through. So don't make it so formal if you don't have to. Not every relationship.
No, not at all. Because I mean, eventually you'll run out of stuff, man. If the person only has so much to give you and, you know, they serve their purpose. If something's formal, you're like, I don't know why you're still around. It becomes a place of tension now. It's like, I have to keep you around due to responsibility. But the lessons that you were meant to provide for me were only supposed to serve me over this short amount of time. So I think it's good to pay attention to that.
So as you're starting Glide and you're thinking about all of the things that are going to, you know, you're just getting going, what, you know, everybody sees, you know, I saw the big moment with TechCrunch Disrupt, which is amazing. I mean, I loved it. I saw that on LinkedIn. I was like, oh, gosh, that's wonderful and validation.
Yes. But
the part that people don't see is like those early days. And so, you know, what were the things that you kind of got wrong that you didn't anticipate? You were like, hey, I got the idea. I got this mission. I'm going to do stuff. And then stuff isn't working.
Yes, absolutely. I you know, in the beginning, it was like, yay, in order for me to raise money or to make, you know, my technology feel like it's real, I need to surround myself with big, you know, logos, like folks that have like mounds of experience and that have worked for like the Apples and the Googles or whatever it may be in order to make my technology seem like it's relevant, right? That was for me, that was a big mistake, right? Because what we're creating is something that's new that legacy systems may not, you know, impact in a positive way. It may root it in something that, you know, is wrong. The other one is identifying, you know, how to really go to market, right? We all want to go to market with that, you know, sexy, futuristic thing that is going to just save everybody's lives, but takes millions and millions of dollars and many years in order to certify and to make safe and to put in place. Was the other mistake that, you know, I led with is like, you know what? I got this big, sexy machine. It's going to just change the world immediately. Just pay for it, right? So go back to basics, identify, you know, how you're going to solve the problem at its most, you know, primitive level. Demonstrate that and then evolve it over time is the lesson that I, you know, got through that obtained through that. And then the next lesson was aligning with the right people that, you know, want to go along with the mission. And not everybody is fit for that time period, right? Yeah. You know, I think that everyone, like seasons, folks have seasons. And you have some folks that are with you for several seasons. You know, it could be with you all the way until the end. And other folks are meant to, you know, get you to a certain posture and, you know, they've served their purpose. So to, you know, not be, you know, too attached, you know, to the idea that, hey, this person is going to carry me to forever. But, you know, acknowledge that, hey, this may be a temporary thing you know, to get us to where we need to be next. So,
yeah. Well, I saw that you're building the team out. And as a CEO, you mentioned early on, like some of those folks, like the Drapers of the world, can help you see your blind spots. And so I feel like part of the trick of being an entrepreneur is understanding what you're really, really, really good at, and then what you may not be, you know, really good at, and you need to either hire for or, you know, learn yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where are you in terms of that CEO archetype?
Yeah.
And what were some of the blind spots that people, if you're comfortable sharing, that said, hey, Kevin, you're amazing at this, but, yeah, you know, we you could use some support around these things.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm the person that wants to do everything. I want to design it. I want to build it. I want to sell it, right? I want to sustain it. I want to operate it. I want to plan for it. You know, I want to raise for it. I want to do it all, right? I want to be, you know, the one man band, right? I want to be Quincy Jones, who's back on the wall as well, right? That can just do it all, the orchestrator, you know, and you find quickly that you run out of bandwidth very fast, right? You can only be superhuman for so long before you start to crack because kryptonite is all around us. So, you know, what I would say, you know, personally about myself is like being able to, you know, disseminate and accept help, you know, for the area, free me up so I can do the things best, to relinquish, you know, some of that control to competent, you know, folks so that they can steer, you know, the company in a direction that it needs to, so we can verticalize it through pillars and displace out instead of it just being a spear. Right now we have, you know, a rope of many, many strands that are braided together to pull this mission, you know, forward. And that's where, you know, a lot of my blind spots were. You know, Glide is my baby. It's everything that I've worked for. It's the culmination of my entire career, is my love note to logistics. But being able to share that page with other folks, I mean, it's something that I've struggled with, you know, for some time. And now starting to, you know, recruit great team members, you know, around me that are like, hey, you know what, man, I can really take this from you and fulfill your mission and dream probably better than you can, but we'll still align, you know, with it. And me being able to, back to that word, surrender to that ideal of it, is propelling us forward in so many different ways. So
amazing, man. Yeah, that, I think that is a tough thing to do as a founder, is to let go of the reins to people that to help the company grow, right? There's only so many places Kevin can be at once.
Yeah. Absolutely. I try to be in all the places, man, but it comes with a sacrifice, right?
Mm.
You can't do that everywhere. So, and I'm not going into a cloning machine. So it's...
Well, you tempted me with that one. We could talk about that for a while.
Yeah.
I've been experimenting with agents recently, and what a crazy world.
Crazy world.
So once you get past this kind of wilderness phase of, like, you know, of having this vision, and then, you know, you're working on it, you're iterating on it, and then you pitch it, right? And I was mm-hmm. reading online that your very first customer, Taylor Transport, he said, man, I didn't think this technology would be available in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
What a validating moment, I'm sure, that had to be when someone who's like, hey, this, I see the problem and I want to buy the solution that you are providing. You know, talk to me how did that happen, and what did that mean for you, both personally as a founder, but then also for the company?
Yeah, absolutely. So we were, you know, going around knocking on doors and doing market research and pitching the product. You know, at that time it was a paper napkin sketch and an idea, right? With a bone squad of one or two, you know, of us, you know, going door to door and, you know, sending out railroad operators and truckers, you know, drayage truckers, I mean, construction folks as well, you know, that move their stuff. And Mike Loboke, you know, president and CEO of Taylor Transport, you know, was all three at one time, you know, has worked in transportation his whole life, loved transportation, loved logistics, started out driving truck. And now, you know, he's running this big, great, you know, trucking company, railroad company and construction company in Vancouver, Washington. And to sit down with them and to explain the story and to see his eyes light up and say, I needed this like 25 years ago, was the most validating thing, you know. And, you know, for him to say, I always ask folks why this isn't being done, you know, why aren't we leveraging more rail? I have rail sitting in my backyard and I barely see any, you know, cargo move down it. I can't even put my own truck or my own product, you know, on that thing because I don't have enough to fulfill it. And for them to say, yeah, you guys are the next thing up, was like winning the Super Bowl, the World Series, and the Stanley Cup all at the same time, very, very early on. This was 2023. Right before, you know, Glide was a, you know, like a name at all, right? I mean, we got Crunches Rup in 2020. We got our first venture funding in 2025 and then got our first opportunity to, you know, be on something that is worth anything in 2024 through the Veterans Fund. A little bit before that was for the Automated Vehicle Conference where they let me take the stage. But, you know, 2023, it was like, you guys are dreamers, right? You guys are, you know, smoking the best stuff on the planet. And, you know, you guys are way outside of what reality is. And then for him to say yes was really validating. He's still a very, very firm supporter in Glide. And we're working towards, you know, fulfilling, you know, that contractual agreement, you know, that we settled on in 2023. So,
wow. So yeah. How did you, I think a lot of founders will find this or people that are thinking about this, right? Because this is this tension that always exists in the early days. Maybe I'm assuming to build what you guys are building is not cheap.
You ain't worried.
Maybe that's an understatement, but kind of what I've seen of it, you know, I can imagine that this is not cheap technology to build, and not just the technology, but the platform, you know, across GPS denied areas in the dual use context. So there's a lot that would go into building something like this, maybe more than maybe most founders, you know, think about, right? So this is a heavy investment. How did you go in and, you know, what it is that you were doing so that he could see that vision, but also believe that Kevin's going to deliver on this. It's not just this thing. Yeah. Yeah. That sounds great, Kevin, but
yeah,
you know, are you going to be able to deliver on this? I think that's a challenge a lot of founders go through is like, okay, I sell the vision, but it's got to be more than that. So how did you go into that meeting and talk to Mike about, hey, this is what we're trying to do. How, can you join us on that journey?
Yeah, absolutely. I led with why me, right? Why am I the guy to deliver this product to you, right? I think it's, you know, one thing that folks say is like, I had this great idea to build this great product. And another thing is like, I've lived this idea to build this great product. I know how to build this product because I've been building this product my entire life and in some way, shape or form, but it just hasn't come out yet. And to provide that folk, that person with that guarantee that you are the person to do it. I've been sent to fulfill this mission hands down, and I won't quit until it's actually fulfilled. And that was a determination that Mike did, because, you know, the price came up. It's like, man, this thing is going to cost millions in order to do that. And, you know, my response was like, I can build this not for millions. I can build this, you know, quite cheaply because I know the componentry. I have the relationships. I've lived in this problem my entire life where I can look at the units of economics, string together networks in order to assemble a product that can serve your purpose. And at the cost that I'm telling you at, it's going to be at, that's going to be cheaper than everything else out there. And at a time as well as a quality that is on par, but with what you suspect. And that was a conviction that he was like, yeah, like, I believe you, but I'm going to make you prove it to me. But what you said, you know, can you do it? And we've done it. You know, we've raised some money, but what we've built with the capital that we've raised, we haven't raised, you know, tens and 20 and 30 and $100 million, you know, we've raised, you know, $8 million to date. And, you know, we have, you know, three great vehicles with another one on its way. And then a software product with a full team, you know, where a lot of other companies, you know, raise way more money than we have, don't have a product, have a team, and it's still trying to figure it out. Well, we have product that is ready to field with, you know, commercial contracts as well as defense contracts to pilot out, to prove out, you know, our solution. So yeah, we're making good
that. So capital efficiency, I want to stay on this out. So I did an episode with two guys that are building an electric sports car.
That's cool. Who are they?
Maybe I'll connect you guys.
Okay, cool.
But one of the things that they were talking about, I'm just wondering if this applies to you, is, you know, they said in F1 racing, you can spend millions of dollars on a fender, like a custom you know, light. And their approach was different. They were using off-the-shelf components that have millions of miles of use and test cases. And because of that, their unit of economics and their ability to deliver is, you know, much stronger, right? So they're not, you know, there's off-the-shelf things that they can kind of assemble in a new way that yes. allow them to do what they're doing. Is that kind of the approach that you guys are taking here?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we do. I mean, unit economics are in commercial off-the-shelf products, right? Doing an integrated product that already has full certification, especially across the two, you know, severely heavy regulatory bodies that we service from the road side and then on the rail side, helps us get, you know, homologation as well as speed to market very fast. We have a robust product out of the gate as well. And then, you know, our patented moat is involved in the functionality of deployment, not so much in the actual device itself. I think folks that build that way are very smart. They can get really fast feedback from the market and still be able to build at a rate that is faster than others that are trying to reinvent the wheel. The wheel is there, so use the wheel and then, you know, evolve the things that need to be evolved, right? So leveraging, you know, your secret sauce, you know, how do you package this thing up to be different than others to serve a purpose? How do you overlay emerging technologies into that integrated product to continue to propel your product offering? And then how do you overlay a service on top of that in order to bring your cost down and your value up are the things that we really focus on at Glide.
Yeah, that's super smart. And just as people are listening, I think sometimes it's, you know, what can we do? You don't have to reinvent everything in your, especially if you have a hardware product, right? You can use things that have had lots of tests and use cases and get you quick speed to market. And then learn, you know, like you said, have that secret sauce within that. And sometimes the secret sauce is just the way you assemble those things differently than anybody else, right? And so
Absolutely.
That's smart. And I'm sure your investors love that you are incredibly capital efficient.
Absolutely. A little bit goes a long ways for us at Glide. So
tell me, I know we're getting close on time here, Kevin, but you know, there's a weight to, as I was reading the story about Iraq and some of the issues that you guys were running into there, and you were saying, hey, this is just the way it's done. You get the job done, but you're in a dual use context and you know what it's like to be that guy or girl who's having to do that. You know, is there a weight as you think about that in the kind of dual use context that, hey, this thing that we're building, yes, it does have, you know, commercial use for tail of transport and others like it, but it also has a use case where the consequences are real in terms of, like, you know, could be life or death for those soldiers. You know, is there a weight to that for you?
Oh, it's heavy for me. It's the thing that is most bounding for me. There's two big issues that I really like to address that keeps me moving. The first is that we talked about earlier, the marginalized communities that are impacted by the underutilization of infrastructure. The second one is our warfighters and our national security and the folks that have been called and have answered the call in order to, you know, robust our national security. So, you know, supporting a warfighter in garrison as they stage and train to deploy out to geopolitical tensions around the world and in how they're serviced in contested environments, you know, logistically is something that weighs heavy on me. You know, out of a logistical mission, you know, one out of five missions, there's a loss. There's a life that's lost during logistical missions, right? Convoys that are going out to, you know, pick up scrap pieces of equipment to bring it back to base so that we don't leave IP in the enemy's hands, and those convoys being decimated, where you could have sent, you know, Raiden, you know, out to go get that stuff. If Raiden's loss is no big deal, but you know, circumstances like that, or even railhead operations where you don't need to have, you know, troops at the line side to, you know, move their munitions from road to rail. They can just be, you know, at the point of embarkation and debarkation on either side to receive it while the thing does its thing along the way. And then the commander, you know, looks at Ezra 1.6, which is our software, to ensure that it's proceeding as planned. And that saves lives, saves time, it saves effort, and it deploys American dollars into things that we really need to deploy into, like medicine. So yeah, that's my pool.
Yeah. That's, you know, I think when I first was learning about Glide, I did not see all of the social aspects of, you're like, hey, it's a railroad.
Yes.
But there's a lot to this, and I can see why people are attracted to this mission, the mission that you guys are on, in terms of just the problem you're solving, but the effects that has both in the commercial and dual use space. So incredibly proud of the work that you're doing, man. You know, cool stuff. And that it would do this all autonomously is like next level.
Yeah, let's go,
man.
What's human in the loop? I mean, we want to employ folks. So I mean, you think about it from a next gen job perspective. Now we have like digital twin operators, and we have you know mechanics that service things from the safety of their home, working with robotics as well. You know, you're teaching folks that don't have degrees in engineering and automation. To do things that they don't need degrees from, and provide them with paychecks that are on par with engineers is another big piece of our mission. So making logistics sexy again.
Hey, I love it. That's a new slogan. Now, I know you do have a slogan.
Yes.
On the back.
Yes.
Tell me about it, because when I first read it, I didn't really understand it. And then you explained it to me. You know, let's talk about that slogan for a second. And then I got one last question for you.
Okay, gotcha. So when I look at, you know, I've been shipping goods for a long time, right? And shipments have their own problems within it. So I say, the next time you go ship it, don't ship it, just glide it, right? So gliding should be the easiest way that you move anything, right? If you think about just the movement of gliding, it's effortless. Right. So logistics should be effortless. And that's our main thing that we want to do at Glide, is make your shipment and all shipments as effortless as gliding. So let's glide.
Yeah, I love it. I love it, man. Well, as you are thinking, you know, I know you're in the middle of the fight, but as you're thinking about your journey and people who, you know, are maybe on a different stage of that climb, mm-hmm. and you're thinking back at like early Kevin and saying, hey, if I was going to give advice to my younger self, or someone who is at that stage, thinking, man, I want to be where Kevin's at.
Yeah.
How do I get there?
Yeah.
You know, what would you say to them? What would you say to yourself in that moment?
I would say, keep going, right? It gets better if you believe in it, right? The mission's bigger than you. You know, seek help at every corner. Don't pretend to know what you don't know. Be honest and transparent about it all, and be brave, right? Take chances. The sacrifices will pay dividends into the triumphs. So keep investing in those sacrifices, but make sure they're measured, and take care of yourself while doing so, right? Because you are the core pillar to make things happen. And then the last thing is, things aren't done alone. You know, seek a community and ecosystem to get you there. Whether that ecosystem is a capital factory or a new lab or a UCR, or an incubator like Antler, or an investor community like, you know, the Veterans Fund or Outlander, you know, seek those folks to push you forward, even if it isn't you taking money from these folks. But, you know, advice are pay dividends into you actually getting that investment. Network effects are real. So yeah.
Oh, amazing, Kevin. And I love the story. I love the mission.
Thank you.
From backup dancer to changing the world.
Let's ride.
And everything in between, man.
Yes.
It has been such a pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you for sharing your wisdom and your faith and the mission that you guys are on with our audience, and those 50 Chairs moments that, you know, aren't the things that make the LinkedIn and the Instagram reel, but they're part of the journey, right?
Yes, sir.
So if people want to find you, where can they find you?
Yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm not a social media person, but LinkedIn is the best place to reach out to us. You can find us on our company's page as well, Glide, or our website, Glide Tech, GLID Tech. tech.us. And if you see me at conferences, I'm there. You know, pull up, say hello. Gary, thank you so much for having me, you know, on this amazing platform, man, and being able to have this really, really honest and deep conversation with me. I hope that you have a blessed and abundant day, brother, in all that you do.
I want to say thank you to all the listeners of the 50 Chairs podcast. being able to bring all of these guests who can share their expertise and advice as they've gone through their 50 Chairs moments has been a great joy and privilege. And if you're getting any value out of this, the best thing you can do to support our channel is to like us on Apple, on Spotify, or on YouTube, or share it with a friend who's going through their own 50 Chairs moments and needs to hear one of these stories. Thanks again for listening.